Welcome. I'm Sarah White, a retired director of pharmacy with a continuing interest in effective pharmacy leadership. The purpose of this conversation with a very successful person is to hear in their own words the lessons they've learned, the experiences they have, so we can all become better leaders. I would like to welcome Lucinda Main, and by way of a brief introduction on Lucinda's career, she received her pharmacy degree from Auburn in 1980, completed a PhD in 1985 at the University of Minnesota, has worked as a School of Pharmacy Associate Dean and Acting Dean at Samford University, and before taking her current position as Executive Vice President and CEO of the American Association of Colleges of Pharmacy, she served in several senior staff positions with the American Pharmaceutical Association. So, Lucinda, welcome. You graduated in 1980. Tell us the story around how you chose pharmacy as a career.
It was a little accidental, actually, or maybe coincidental is a better term to use. I had grown up thinking I was going to be a teacher, and a first grade teacher, to be exact, inspired by my very own first grade teacher in North Stonington, Connecticut. And I carried that for a long time, probably until junior high, when I got into some of the biological and other sciences, and I found them fascinating. And so that began to make me question my teaching aspiration. It was actually my stepfather, who built submarines for a living, who said to me as I was approaching my freshman year at Auburn, "Have you ever thought about pharmacy?" And I looked at him and I said, "No, never." And he said, "You should go talk to our pharmacist." Just a classic, great community pharmacist in Mobile, Alabama. And Charles Dart said to me what many people have heard, especially young women, "Wonderful career, Lucinda, wonderful career. You go to school for 5 years, you come out, you make $20,000. And if you want to work part-time when you raise a family, you can do that too." And quite frankly, I never looked back. I took his advice. I enrolled as a pre-pharmacy student at Auburn, got in 2 years later, and graduated with my bachelor's degree, as you mentioned. And the rest is history.
And even when you graduated in 1980, you joined a profession that was predominantly male. What were some challenges around being a female in a male-dominated profession?
It's a really interesting time, because I think that my class at Auburn was perhaps the first class there where the balance was 50-50. And so, you know, I looked to my right and I looked to my left, and I wasn't alone. You know, there were many, many other women in my class. And that was true across the country, and it was true in the associations that we got involved with at the local and national level. And so, to a certain extent, I didn't feel like a minority as a student or as a young practitioner. It was also a very interesting time in that the profession's leaders were waking up and saying, "Whew, there's a lot of women coming into the profession. We wonder what the impact of that will be." And some enlightened leaders said, "We probably better make sure that we nurture women as future leaders equally as men." And I've always felt in that regard, Sarah, that the wind was behind my back to a certain extent, versus in my face. And so I think that was truly a really unique time to enter the profession.
And you've served on several task forces mm-hmm. on women in pharmacy, both at the state and national level. Talk a little bit about what those did and their legacy.
Well, the first one was appointed by President Mary Munson Runge at the American Pharmaceutical Association. Mary was the first female pharmacist ever to be president of that National Professional Association. And I was just finishing my term as National SAFA president and just expressed an interest once she announced that she was appointing the task force to being involved in it. I knew it was a very important study. Gave me the opportunity to work with one of our favorite people, Gloria Franke, who is the staff liaison at APHA, and Ken Kirk, who was a very thoughtful young faculty member who had done quite a bit of research on gender issues in the profession and the implications for the profession. And so for a period of well over a year, maybe even close to two, a small group, 12 people, I believe it was, got together numerous times, and the national report on women in pharmacy, I think, was really a landmark contribution, because it did several things. It put the data on the table, the trends, the issues, but it also gave us the opportunity to talk about the things that many were thinking, most were not verbalizing in public, but they were talking about it in the corridors, about whether or not this influx, this change in demography in the profession was going to have positive or negative impact. And the report, I think, was a pretty honest, factual, and conceptual analysis of both the strengths and the opportunities, as well as the threats that this changing demographic represented to the profession. And the report, the national report, had a lot of information about leadership and management and how critically important it was and what did the profession need to do in order to ensure that young women and mid-career women were prepared to step up into leadership roles, since over time, unless the wave turned back, you know, we were going to look at a time as today where the majority of licensed practitioners are women. And we needed to step up into positions of leadership. Then I had the opportunity to take that to the State Pharmacy Association level at Minnesota while I was a graduate student. We used the national report as our template of issues, and then just talked about what should the Minnesota Pharmacists Association, the Colleges of Pharmacy, and others in the state do to make sure that we were prepared to welcome and fully utilize the talent that's represented in the new demographic of women in the profession. I believe, if I'm right, Doris Calhoun was the first female president of the Minnesota Pharmacists Association, so it was no surprise that Doris felt it was an important part of her tenure as president of the association to bring that study closer to home.
Since we've both known Gloria Niemeyer Franke, would you comment on who she was and what her legacy is?
So close to the second anniversary of her death, it's a little hard. But, you know, Gloria was a pioneer from the beginning of time. And unlike me, she looked to her right and to her left and in front and behind, and she was a little lonelier in terms of being a woman in the profession at the time. And at every opportunity, she would hold that letter she got from a not-to-be-named pharmaceutical company who she had applied to after she graduated from pharmacy school. And they simply, bluntly wrote, "We don't hire women." See, we have come a long way. We have come a very long way. But Gloria didn't let that make her bitter. Obviously, a lot of that had to come, I think, with a partnership with Don Franke, who I never had the honor of meeting because he passed just before I got into professional association opportunities to meet people like Don Franke. And I heard just this last week from an individual from Malta who the Frankies took into their home when they were in Cincinnati. He came in, he got enrolled in the PharmD program just as Don enrolled Gloria into the PharmD program. And I think what I learned from her was to take advantage of every opportunity that is presented to you, to be networked with the profession's leaders domestically and internationally. She never missed an opportunity to tell me to expand my circle into global pharmacy. And I guess to always operate from a position of strength and poise and integrity. Dramatically positive lessons.
I met you when you were actually the SAFA president in 1978. You and I were both on an APHA policy council in a room together. So we've known each other for a number of years.
Decades.
Yes, decades. What was the value as a student to being involved in leadership to you and your career?
I think it's not an exaggeration to say that everything I have done and experienced and enjoyed in pharmacy is a result of having had the opportunity to serve as a leader, as a student. There's just no better incubator of vision, of confidence that you can walk up to some of the icons in the profession and they'll befriend you and mentor you and nurture you along. The expansion, whether it's through a committee like the one we served on, or a task force like the one that you mentioned, or simply going to a national or international meeting where some of the profession's best and brightest, as well as those outside the profession who have thoughts about what pharmacy's contribution should be, are right there. And it was gaining that kind of exposure so early in my career and feeling so welcome by the profession, which is really very small if you think about it. And so it's not that difficult to find your way and to find those leaders to learn from. But that was really the benefit to me, was the networks I created, the vision that it instilled in me about the role that pharmacists would play in the future, and a bit of insight about how organizations help you get that work advanced.
Tell us about going back to Minnesota for your PhD.
I knew pretty early in my Auburn bachelor's program that a bachelor's degree was probably not going to be my ticket ultimately to success. And I thought about a lot of things. The post-baccalaureate PharmD was gaining strength and popularity, and I really wanted to take care of patients and help improve their medication use. And so that one was a very logical one. After spending a summer internship in the industry, I began thinking about that powerful combination of the pharmacy and MBA. And so I thought about that for a while, and even actually took some pre-MBA courses before I finished at Auburn. And then by the time I had interned at several different venues of pharmacy, loved them all, had met the likes of Alan Brands when I was a co-step in the Indian Health Service my last summer in pharmacy school, had worked in the association space and met the dreamers in the profession, I quite frankly was really confused about what I wanted to do. And it was because of the task force in women in pharmacy. I was sitting one day with Bonnie Svarstad from Wisconsin and Michael Ira Smith, at that time from Long Island University, but who had gotten his degrees at University of Minnesota. And they said, "Lucinda, what do you want to do when you graduate?" And I ran through I've done this, and I've done this, and I've done this, and I've loved this, and this, and this. And quite frankly, at this point, I'm so confused, I don't know which way to turn. And they looked at each other and they said, "That's a pharmacy administration graduate student if I've ever seen one." And before I knew it, Michael had contacted Albert Wertheimer, and Albert had sent me a packet of admission material for their pharmacy administration, social and administrative pharmacy program. And I said, "Well, this must be the answer." So I enrolled, applied, was accepted, and intended just to go to Minnesota for my master's degree. And in addition to the program itself being interesting, I also was appealing to me that there was the new consulting pharmacy practice in the nursing home environment. I was very interested in issues of drug use in the elderly because there seemed to be real problems there. Minnesota had a very strong state pharmacy association, and I wanted to continue to work in the association arena. And that association had a great relationship with the state legislature, and I knew that policy and politics was a part of the whole equation. So Minnesota seemed to be a really good place to go. And so I went, enrolled, intent only to get a master's degree. And then somehow, coincidentally, I ended up with a PhD instead.
Some interesting other folks have gone through that program. Talk about some of those. Just, you know, names. Drop names.
I'll drop a lot of names. Henry Manassi was one of the earliest graduate students in that program at Minnesota. He studied the sociology of the profession. Richard Burton, who ended up being a chief professional officer for pharmacy and an assistant surgeon general, is now the leader of the Board of Pharmaceutical Specialties. I was in a very unique program in the early 80s called the Pharmaceutical Clinical Scientist Program, which was supported by an important grant from the Kellogg Foundation. And it was co-directed by two of the most important people in my life, Al Wertheimer and Paul Batalden, a physician. And they had picked up the recommendation from the Millis Commission that was done by the American Association of Colleges of Pharmacy, that pharmacy needed a cohort of clinical scientists who were equally comfortable at the bedside and the laboratory, and who were what we call today translational scientists. Mm-hmm. And among the people who were in that program with me, Julie Zito, now at the University of Maryland, who's done some incredibly important work with children and their medication use in the psychiatric realm, Brian Isitz, who's been published now numerous times with research on medication therapy and pharmaceutical care and the role of the pharmacist, and so many other people who now are in important positions in leadership and associations and colleges, the pharmaceutical industry, and you name it, all over the place.
You and your husband, who is also a pharmacist, would be what we call today a dual career couple that have had children. Talk about advice on how to balance both having a fantastic career with a satisfying personal life. What advice do you have?
Recently had a number of young people, women especially, ask me this question. And as I reflect on how I did it, and I'm an N of one, I did it very linearly. I went to pharmacy school and then graduate school. And that, with the exception of working in pharmacy along the way, I didn't try to do that with a husband or children. And so I got grounded educationally. And then I launched my career well before I met Dan. And so was pretty established professionally by the time we met and married. I was 31. I don't mind admitting that. And then we worked together in separate venues. He's a fabulous clinician. And we did that for 10 years before children became part of the equation. And we adopted our children. Happened to be a beautiful way to build a family. And so what I would say to a young person is you've got a lot of years ahead of you. There's nothing wrong with being married and having children and going to school. It's just a lot more difficult. And to the extent that you can get yourself established, then that's really beneficial. Then Dan is a partner. He takes care of the end of the day for the boys, and that gets more and more complicated every year as they get older. I have two teenagers now. But I can't manage the end of my day because of that last email or phone call or, oh, can I meet with you about this? And he does. He's able to manage the end of the day. And so, and he doesn't travel. My job has historically found me traveling quite a bit. And so that partnership, that shared responsibility, I do the grocery store, I do the, you know, a lot of those other kinds of errands, and it just works out that neither of us, hopefully, takes on an extraordinary burden in any one of those dimensions, but we balance it out based on our strengths.
Now, has he always worked full-time once you had the children?
No. Actually, he's got out of working for a hospital pharmacy and launched his own consulting business about a year before the boys came home. And he had some flexibility in that regard. I would say that over the course of the last 14 years, he's probably worked somewhere between two-thirds and 75-80% time. And so I do admit to young people that if you've got two people who are working 100%+ time, that you have to buy a lot of the services that we are able to get away with not buying, whether that's yard care or house care or nanny care or whatever. Fortunately, pharmacy affords us the salary base to buy some of those services to keep ourselves sane. I think if you think you can do it all by yourself, without that kind of help, maybe you have a nice family network and that helps you out, but it's probably not very comfortable or as satisfying as we've found our careers and family life.
You're currently the Executive Vice President and CEO of AACP. Talk a little bit about AACP, the American Association of Colleges of Pharmacy, its mission, its members.
Yeah, we're 110 years old, and for 110 years, our mission has been to improve the quality of pharmacy education in America. And in contrast to the 10 years where I worked at APHA, where that mission and the membership model was so broad and diverse, we wake up every morning and we say, how can we help the schools and colleges of pharmacy and their faculty improve the quality of pharmacy education today? Now, it's not quite as simple as that, because of the interplay between education and the professional practice of pharmacy, and the fact that many pharmacy faculty and schools of pharmacy have played a profound role in evolving new models of practice and studying the impact of those practices on patients and on the healthcare system. And so we can't afford to be ivory tower and isolationists. We really have to think about our mission in the context of the profession, the profession's needs, and society's needs for what our profession does. But every day, our members are now 120 schools and colleges of pharmacy, their deans, their faculty, their professional staff. And so our business model is to design platforms, typically meetings, but not only, publications, study reports and commissions, that really try to help identify what stands in the way sometimes, or what could accelerate the provision of quality pharmacy education in this changing environment. And then we try to build programs and products and services that make it easier for our members to participate and do exactly that.
And your structure is one of a council of deans and a council of faculties. And talk a little bit about that, because that's a little bit different.
It is. We're a very hybrid organization, both in terms of our membership are both schools and individuals. So you have that working for you. And then our council structure is deans, faculty, and then just in the last couple of years, we reintroduced the Council of Sections. And the sections, as in so many organizations, are really the member-serving units of the association. So we have sections of practice faculty and experiential education program directors, and the science faculty, pharmacy administration, like myself. And but the important thing about the councils is those are 9 of the 15 people on the AACP board of directors. And so when we sit around the table four times a year as a board, we pretty much have every interest represented. Now, everybody's doing the same thing. They're all teaching or administering at a college of pharmacy. And so our focus is pretty clear. But the perspectives that those different leaders bring to the table are very valuable. And I've had members of the board, presidents, say the thing I like the most about serving on the AACP board is that when we leave here, we know we've talked about all of the things that are important to the academy right now and in the future. And in that regard, it's a very healthy dynamic at the board table.
Does the elected president alternate between those two structures?
Exactly. So one year, and this year I happen to have a president with a dean in his title, and next year the person will be a faculty person. Could be a chair, which sometimes they are. But yeah, we alternate between faculty and dean.
And I'm certainly happy to see a number of women deans of schools of pharmacy, because most of my career there were no women deans. Talk a little bit about how that's come about.
I remember exactly when it came about. I think I was acting dean at Samford at the time, or maybe it was just before I was acting dean at Samford. And the first full-time dean of pharmacy who was a woman was Adele Titus at Temple. She happened not to be a pharmacist, interestingly enough. She was a higher education administrator. But it was sent a reverberation throughout the profession. And then there was a dean, I think the first pharmacist dean was at the University of Puerto Rico. And so that was in the late 80s, early 90s, which was not very long ago. Mm-hmm. But if you look the progression over the course of the last 10 to 15 years, and you think about some of the more comprehensive schools of pharmacy that are doing excellent education, practice, research, community service. You have Marilyn Speedy at Minnesota. You have Marianne Cota Kimball at UCSF. You have Barbara Wells down at Mississippi. Now, not surprisingly, all three of those have also served as presidents of AACP along the way as well.
You've been an acting dean and an associate dean. What's the role of a dean of a college or school of pharmacy?
I think it's really changing. And I actually incorporated this into a presentation at FIP just this week in Lisbon. The dean, the CEO dean, as I call him or her, chief administrative, chief academic officer of the enterprise, really has a much more external role to play today than they ever have before because of the complexity of the enterprise. They have to have a team, typically of associate and assistant deans, that really take on the responsibility on a day-to-day basis to make sure that the academic program is intact, the research program is intact, the student affairs, admissions, and you know, counseling, advising process is intact, that development is intact, etc. The dean, therefore, is really at liberty to work the external constituencies. Mm-hmm. That's up the organization within the university itself, but it's also the alumni, of course, corporate and other supporters, the community, to be a state, national, maybe even an international leader, and to bring back to the college the perspectives that are so critically important to keep the program on point with what's happening today and is coming on downstream. And so I really do see the role of the academic dean is as that external liaison between the college and the world, the faculty and the world, and then the associate and assistant deans really run the place.
And as the paid staff for AACP, how do you attempt to work effectively with the elected leaders, the presidents, the board, et cetera?
I think it's really a partnership model, and it's not just me in partnership with the board. I am a member of the board of 15, but my senior staff as well. And there's a respect that's really palpable when we're sitting in a board meeting, because the board knows that they're there to establish priorities, to set the vision, to ground us on what's really happening out there in the real world of pharmacy education today, but that we do the work of AACP 24/7, 365. Not quite, but. And through working with various project teams of staff and other leaders at the section and council level, that we have the strategies to put in place. And then they help provide the resources that we need to advance those important priorities. And we do that through planning. Just approved a new strategic plan that comes through our House of Delegates. And so that's another component of our governance model, two delegates for every one of our schools that try and make sure that we are really keeping point with the needs of the colleges and schools of pharmacy. And then we just, through meetings, study commissions, committees, task force reports, just kind of try to keep the train running in a smooth and competent way.
Do you do some leadership training for newly elected officials?
We do. We have a leadership orientation process that was a little ad hoc until the last year or two, and now we try to take them systematically through things like our budgeting and financial management process, how we run our meetings, how the agendas are structured, how they contribute to that, the organizational structure itself, how we do planning, how they contribute, how their constituencies contribute. So that's a very important part of being an effective AACP leader. And almost all of our terms now are 3-year terms on the board. The only exception to that is the 2-year term as speaker. And so I think with half a year of orientation and then a 3-year term, people come in feeling pretty ready to contribute. And then, you know, by the end of their first year, I think they're feeling fairly comfortable. Now, we also instituted about 7 years ago a very important program. I mentioned Barbara Wells when she was president in 2002-03, the potential vacuum of leadership downstream in pharmacy education was a great concern to her, as it has been over time, but she really focused our attention on that. And we launched a 1-year academic leadership fellows program, which is going to, by the end of this cohort, have graduated over 200 people in cohorts of 25 to 30. And they are the up-and-coming leaders of academic pharmacy and the mm-hmm. profession. Mm-hmm. Number have become deans already. Not that this is necessarily the dean training program, because there's lots of other important leadership roles to play in academic pharmacy. But the vast majority of them are still working, have taken on new positions of leadership at their college, and are poised to really make a contribution.
Describe a little bit what that program entails.
It's four, as I mentioned, there are 25 to 30 people. They're broken into groups of 5 or 6, and each of those groups has a dean facilitator, an experienced dean who comes in and works with that small group. Each group does a group project, but we get them together 4 times over the course of the year. They go to camp in August, and they are exposed to all kinds of leadership models and theories. They're asked to write a personal vision statement and really reflect. It's a very reflective program. Provide them a lot of written resources from the Harvard Business Review and some of the 21,000 leadership titles that exist in the library today. They come back in November to Washington again, and that session is more focused on their role as advocates for the profession of pharmacy, both in higher education and outside in the political context. And they'll do Hill visits and meet with some public policymakers at that time. Then in February, they meet coincident with our February interim meeting, which is a meeting that's focused on leadership and advocacy and outreach. And they do a little bit there in that session on work-life balance and how to make all of this come together. Then their final session is at the annual meeting. As much that's their graduation celebration, but they present their fellow projects at that meeting and do a little bit more coursework and a pre-session on leadership. And so it's the program is profound in how fast the group bonds, both within those groups of five or six and then the broader group of 25 or 30. So they're getting a network, and they're learning how to use that network to identify and solve problems and evolve themselves personally and professionally. And then we understand that those networks stay intact over the years after the program, and that they continue to work together on projects that they're passionate about.
You mentioned doing commissions and task forces. Tell us a little bit about the Argus Commission.
Mm-hmm. The Argus Commission is the last five presidents of AACP. And they are given probably the most out there, strategic, environmental scanning charge of any of our standing committees or commissions. It differs from year to year. 2 years ago, it was how do the schools and colleges of pharmacy make agents of change for the profession? I know that's something that the ASHP Foundation is similarly passionate and concerned about at once. This past year, they took a look at the important question of how would other disciplines in the health professions embrace or not pharmacists' contribution to primary care, because primary care pharmacy services was the top issue for our then president, Jeff Baldwin, mm-hmm. for 2009-10. Mm-hmm. And Argus met with representatives from medicine, nursing, dentistry, the physician's assistant community, and public health. And they can take a really sensitive or meaty issue like that, mm-hmm. but because of their previous experience and leadership, both at their colleges and in AACP, really bring a lot of valuable leadership insight and perspective to that particular issue. So if you go back over time and read the issues of or the reports of the Argus Commission, which were all published in our online journal, mm-hmm. I think you'll find a lot of insights that are very valuable and very contemporary for the profession.
Let's step back and trace your career. You're now only one of two women who lead national pharmacy organizations. The other woman is not a pharmacist.
Right.
How did you position yourself? What's your career evolve? Tell us those stories.
As I was going to the finalist interview for my current position, I started thinking, now what are they going to ask? And I said, I bet they're going to ask how my previous experience prepares me for my current role. And so I took out a sheet of paper and I wrote a timeline. September 1974, enrolled at Auburn University as a pre-pharmacy student. And what I realized was from pre-pharmacy to pharmacy at the bachelor's level, then on to graduate school and in a very unique program, two positions in an academic career, first as an associate professor of pharmacy practice, and then, as you mentioned, as an associate dean at Samford University. All the while, I was staying involved in pharmacy associations, both at the state and at the national level, because I appreciated how important those networking opportunities were in a number of different ways. At a point after I'd served as acting dean, I had the opportunity to step back and say, what do you want to do next? You've been in academics now for 7 years. You could certainly continue there, as many people do, for another 20, 30 years. Or you could try something different. And I was offered the opportunity to come to work for the American Pharmaceutical Association in senior leadership. And it seemed to be very, very logical. And had a variety of different responsibilities at APHA over that 10-year period of time. And then that was the juncture where I was preparing for my interview with our board at AACP. And I looked at that chronology. And it was the first question they asked me in the interview. And so I pulled out my piece of paper and I ran through the chronology and I said, you know what I realized in doing this analysis? This is everything I've done up until this point in time is germane to what you need your CEO to have experienced or learned from or have done. I said, so I guess I'm the perfect person for the position.
You were involved in the series of conferences entitled Pharmacy in the 21st Century. Talk a little bit about what those were and how that has evolved or played out.
There have been a number of those conferences, and they occurred at every five-year intervals since 1984. The first one was planned by two iconic leaders, Jerry Halperin and a public health service leader. And they involved 17 organizations in the profession, but it wasn't a profession-sponsored conference. They did a classic scenario planning. You know, what if pharmacy disappears? What if we take off, et cetera? Beginning in 1989, the Joint Commission for Pharmacy Practitioners took over the planning of the every five-year strategic planning conference on behalf of the profession. And my first one that I participated in as an attendee was in 1989 in Kings Mill, Virginia. And quite frankly, that was when the profession articulated the need for a new mission. And quite frankly, that mission needed to be patient-centered pharmaceutical care, heavily influenced by the work of Doug Hepler and Linda Strand at the time. 5 years later, I actually planned the 1994 Pharmacy in the 21st Century Conference because it was APHA's turn to take that role. And we took a look at, okay, if the profession has a new mission, how does that mission manifest in the community, ambulatory setting, institutional setting, managed care, and long-term care? And that was how we organized. And we took a look, the outcome of that conference was, what do the practitioners in that setting need to do? Mm-hmm. What do the leaders in that setting need to do? And what do the organizations that represent the pharmacists in those settings need to be doing to realize this new envisioned future? When Bill Zellmer took responsibility for the 1999 Pharmacy in the 21st Century, figured the 21st century was so close we probably shouldn't call it that. Mm-hmm. And we looked at medication use and we brought medicine, nursing, and other administrators into that conference. The awakening was that we had this all figured out, but without the partners that were other stakeholders in the medication use process, we weren't going to make the progress that the profession and society needed us to make mm-hmm. with respect mm-hmm. to introducing pharmaceutical care. Now, as a matter of timing, I've always regretted that conference was 1 month before the Institute of Medicine released the report to Air as Human. Because quite frankly, it was hard to get other disciplines to come to our conference to talk about problems with medication use. We just didn't feel comfortable, I don't think, or they didn't feel comfortable acknowledging that all was not well in the medication use realm. That was a very important conference because those that did come affirmed that there was important work to do to improve the quality of medication use and that pharmacists had a very central role in doing that. Then the IOM reports, and everybody could talk about it, which was very valuable. The last one was interesting because in 2004, around the JCPP table, we said it's time to do this again, but maybe we need to spend our time really honing in on this vision of pharmacists taking the responsibility for optimal outcomes from patients' medication use. Make sure that that's truly our shared vision and then come up with action plans that will allow us to move that vision forward. And so rather than convening a great big conference as we had done every 5 years, we simply dedicated much of the time at the JCPP table every quarter for the last 6 years to looking at what the future was for 2015, what the action plans were that would move us toward that vision, and then each organization alone and in partnerships sometimes would come back and report in to JCPP about how we were working to move that vision forward. And I think that was key, that the work we had done together was key to the progress we made in the health reform legislation in March of 2010.
And there, I know ASHP has a 2015 agenda, which has come from this.
Very consistent with right. the global approach, but very focused on hospital and health system pharmacy.
Could you talk a little bit about what JCPP is and who sits around that table?
Mm-hmm. It's been around for now more than 30 years. And today it's comprised of 11 organizations, 11 national organizations. Seven of those are practitioner organizations, including ASHP. And four of them are organizations like mine that are affiliates, AACP, the accrediting body, the regulators, and the National Alliance of State Pharmacy Associations. And four times a year, we bring our chief elected officers and the chief executive officers of those 11 organizations around a square table. Mm-hmm. And we build an agenda jointly mm-hmm. that has, as I mentioned, focused on the 2015 vision. Sometimes we'll bring in an outside person. There's a new chief professional officer for pharmacy, and he came and visited with the JCPP attendees mm-hmm. At our August meeting mm-hmm. and let us know that our passion is his passion mm-hmm. and that we stand ready to help him be successful and vice versa. So it's a great platform for that kind of visioning and sharing of information and strategy, and also to help coalesce partnerships of maybe all of the JCPP organizations sometimes, maybe just a subset mm-hmm. of them in some cases. And then sometimes we even go beyond just the JCPP folks to incorporate other stakeholders in whatever it is the project is that we need to get accomplished.
In addition to being SAFA president, you have been active. You've been on the APHA board as an elected official, chair of the APHA House. What value over your career of being involved has helped you?
It's probably in three dimensions. One is the vision piece. It's very easy when you're doing your workaday work, you know, on the front lines of patient care or administration, to be so deep in the foxhole that it's really hard to see what's on the horizon and to find out who else has already dealt with this problem that you're dealing with. So the second piece of value is the people you meet and the network that you grow. And knowing that you can, you know, put out a question to a group of people who, and somebody invariably is going to step up and say, oh, you know, I dealt with that a couple weeks, months, years ago, and here's what I did. And then I think the other value is just a very internal value of really feeling like it gives you an opportunity to pay back and to make a contribution and to be part of an important profession that has a really important role to play in society.
What career advice do you offer young pharmacists these days?
I think success starts with knowing what you're passionate about. Yep. We can get out of school now in 6 or so years, and notwithstanding the economy today, go pretty much any place in the country and get a really good job, six figures and beyond. But unfortunately, I think too many people have done that and have approached it only as a job rather than as a passion, as a calling, as a career. And to me, that would be very unsatisfying. And so identify, spend some time thinking. And it could be a very little passion. Mine started as the problem of medication use in the elderly, which I was hearing was really a problem. Now for me, that passion broadened beyond just the elderly to medication use in general. And what was it going to take to really deploy pharmacists, who are my ace card, to make medication use better, safer, more effective? So find that passion and then make sure that the position that you find yourself in feeds that passion, and that you in turn are able to use your passion, your insights, your knowledge to do that job really well and make a contribution. So don't approach it just as a job, approach it as a calling. Make sure that you're feeding your passion and that your passion is feeding into your work. And then don't think you're all doing it all by yourself. Make sure that you are, you know, in a group of peers and colleagues with the right role models, mentors, et cetera, to help you make a maximum contribution.
Thinking back over your career, who have been some of your mentors and what have they done for you?
I think probably the two most important mentors that I've had were the co-directors of the Kellogg program at the University of Minnesota. And they both continue to be valuable mentors and colleagues for me today.
Albert Wertheimer was one PhD-trained pharmacy person. The other, ironically, was a pediatrician, and my interest was drug use in the elderly. But Paul Batalden taught me about quality, quality improvement, quality measurement, and how you do that in a microsystem or how you do that in a broader system. He was instrumental, by the way, in creating the Institute for Healthcare Improvement with Don Berwick. John Ganz is an important mentor for me. Joe Otis, organizationally, was an important mentor for me. Mm-hmm. They were people who were always open, who were interested in what I was doing, how I was doing it, how could they help me do it better. And then along the way, you know, a variety of other people who may have been project mentors. Interestingly, though, right now in my life, I have shifted to a coach. And I really encourage administrators especially, because when you're the CEO of something, it can be a fairly lonely position, or the chief of pharmacy in whatever context. You often can't take a problem to your to your subordinates, and if you don't have a trusted peer group outside of the department, then who do you turn to? And so I adopted an executive coach about 3 years ago, and we do most of our work telephonically. But she always asks me really important questions about where I'm going and who I'm going there with and what do I think I'm going to encounter along the way. And just a very nice, coached, reflective conversation about how to be successful.
So how did you go about finding her as a coach?
I had met this person through a colleague in pharmacy who had called us together to do a visioning exercise. And then, coincidentally, he was in touch with me right about the time that I began looking for a coach. And my board, to their credit, when I finished my first five-year contract, said, "Lucinda, we want to make sure that we're doing enough for your personal leadership and executive development. And tell us what you need, and we'll provide it." And so I decided I didn't need to go to Harvard for 2 weeks for one of those fancy, expensive programs. I did enough traveling. And a colleague, my peer in nursing education, just made an offhand comment about working with her coach. So I interviewed her coach, and I interviewed this person, and just found the chemistry to be so much better with with Sylvia, who I currently work with. And the rest is kind of history. Now, there are organizations of professional coaches. You know, just look it up on Google, and it'll take you to a directory. Your coach doesn't have to be in the same city with you, because Sylvia works from Santa Fe, San Francisco, and the White Mountains up in the Poconos. And we don't get together face-to-face very often. It's mostly telephonic.
So what's the difference, in your view, between a coach and a mentor?
Probably a fairly gray zone, because I think what you get from each has a lot of similarities. Now, I pay my coach per unit of time, and most mentoring relationships are much more voluntary. And I think when I think about who I've looked to for mentoring experience, it's typically somebody in my field, and they are acknowledged leaders. That's not the answer for everybody, but for me, you know, they've been important leaders that have that vision and that wisdom and that perspective. They know who is who in pharmacy to help me move forward. Mm-hmm. And not so my coach. My coach is a professional who understands how people get to be successful and know how to ask the right questions about where are you today. Where is that in relationship to where you want to go? Have you thought about this, this, and this en route to getting there? We spend a lot of time actually talking about my senior leadership team, mm-hmm. how I'm calling upon them to help advance the work mm-hmm. of the association. And so I guess it's a little bit different, but a lot of the value between mentoring and coaching is quite similar.
Thinking back over your days at APHA, what are you proudest of with that relationship?
I think that we really helped turn the table on recognizing the changing role of the pharmacist. And I think during that era, from 92 to 2002, in some part because of the visioning, the strategic visioning mm-hmm. through P21, mm-hmm. we got the entire profession and its organizations, nationally and very much at the state level, on the new vision. And we also learned during that period of time, largely because the Clinton administration, when they came to town to change healthcare, told us in no uncertain terms that we weren't going to talk to 14 different pharmacy organizations. So go home, get your message straight, figure out what you want, and come back and talk to us as a group. And that's when a variety of alliances and coalitions that aren't maybe the same today as they mm-hmm. were 10 years ago, mm-hmm. 10, 15 years mm-hmm. ago, but we learned the discipline of working collaboratively. And again, took that into the health reform debate in 2009, 2010, and our ability to do that, our comfort, and we get better at it all the time, really made a difference in that piece of public policy formation.
What do you think are the keys to being a successful paid professional organization staff person, whether you're at the top like you are now or at, you know, a senior level like you were with APHA?
I think you have to have a certain amount of content expertise. I think it would be very hard for me to do my current job if I didn't have any experience in pharmacy education. And I also think, you know, the valuable senior leadership experience, management experience that I had at APHA, folds into my being successful in my current position. I also had the experience on both sides of the table. I was a board member at APHA, and I was also a senior staff person, so I saw that one organization from both dimensions. But now I go into my position with an appreciation of the roles that we each play, the senior staff and the elected leadership. Respect and a spirit of collaboration. And then I think, and I'm not perfectly good at this because I'm one of those vision people, but the discipline of planning and making sure that you do have the resources allocated to accomplish the things that are on the table. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes saying the resources aren't here right now to do this, even though it might sound like a really good idea. So I think all of those feed into being successful organizationally.
You've been Speaker of the APHA House. What is the role of a Speaker, and what are the challenges of being the Speaker of the House, whether ASHP, APHA, AACP?
I think it's the best job in an organization, quite frankly, because it is the place where a lot of voices come together. We are we're a small profession, but we're a diverse profession. And so in the APHA House, the ability to bring national organizations' perspectives, state organizations' perspectives, pharmacists from every walk of life into an assembly, and to have a process for policy formation that some people find a little bit complex and hard to understand and convoluted, your role as a speaker is to make sure that the participants understand the process, mm-hmm. that they're comfortable with the process, they know how to bring work into and get work done in the process, and then for a couple of hours a year, standing before that body and making sure that the work is conducted in a logical, orderly, not mechanical, because that's pretty boring, but as in as logical a way as we possibly can get it done in order to get the good outcome, the good statement of policy, the position of the organization. Because APHA, ASHP, AACP, we draw upon those positions mm-hmm. countless times and in countless ways mm-hmm. to advance the work of the profession and the organization. So it's a really satisfying position.
The House of Delegates really is the policy approval process in those organizations.
That's right.
And they represent the members through that kind of democratic
I was going to say, in a very democratic body, yes.
Yeah. As you think back over your career, are there some lessons you wish you'd have learned earlier rather than later?
Yes, and yet at the same time, I recognize that everything has a time and everything has a place. my current position affords me opportunities to work with a number of similar organizations outside of pharmacy. So I work with the Association of American Medical Colleges, the American Association of College of Nursing, Dentistry, etc. And I have found that to be extraordinarily rewarding and productive. We're working together right now on how do we make interprofessional education and practice easier for our member schools and colleges to do. Mm-hmm. What more exciting opportunity is there than that? And so the lesson that I think I've taken away is that pharmacy probably spends a little too much time looking inward and would likely, and I think we are poised right now at this moment in time, to spend much more of our energy focused in working and networking externally. And because medication use is central to quality patient care. And other people are coming to be more aware of that, and at the same time are aware that the members, that the graduates my members produce are central to delivering the services that are required to make medication use safer and more effective. And so it's really an exciting time. But if I could do anything, I probably would learn that lesson of externality a little sooner.
So far in your career, what's brought you the most satisfaction?
It's the accumulation. If you think about a couple of things that have happened just this year, 2010, we did get medication therapy management services integrated into health reform. There was a brilliant piece on primary care that Marie Smith from UConn had accepted and published and profiled in Health Affairs in an issue on reinventing primary care. And it says the pharmacist has a critically important role to play in the patient-centered health home. You have the PCC on June 22nd adopting a policy on medication management in the patient-centered primary care home that has a very prominent role to play for pharmacists. I can look back over 30 years now and think about the baby steps that contributed to us getting to that point. Are there people, including myself, who are frustrated that it's taken us 30 years or longer to do that? Yes. But I think that knowing that, whether it was through P21, JCPP, some project that I worked on at APHA, the roles of the schools and colleges of pharmacy, that all of that, I was part of that history and those baby steps at various points along the way is really, truly very satisfying.
Well, you certainly continue to have an excellent career. We really thank you. You're such a role model for women that are in the profession now, have been in the profession, and I certainly thank you for spending your time to let us record this conversation. Thank you.
Been a pleasure.